The Marvelettes. The Marvelettes. On this day in history, 1961, Please, Mr. Postman came out. The Marvelettes, one of the great songs, I think, of all time. When the twist was in, and I was in. Now, so that was, we celebrate this on this day, on our day in history. We take a switch here in this hour, but not really, because these things are all connected to what we've been talking about in the last hour. The start of because of a coming up this Saturday design and visualization is going to happen at MICA, and the two artists who are doing that are with us here, and two other artists in the studio to talk about that exhibit, but just about the whole nature of visualizing what goes around us, how art plays into that in our lives, and the power of art in our lives that we just don't always see and don't put at the forefront of who we are, always put it in the back of what we are. So we're joined here in studio. Paul Rucker is with us, artist in residence at Maryland Institute College of Art, and still here, hasn't run back to Seattle yet. It's good to have you back. Still in Baltimore?
Still here.
Still here.
Enjoying it, yes.
Good. And Isabella's with us on the phone? No, not yet?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Great. How do you say your last name? Say it right.
Mierlis.
Okay, make sure I have that right. Isabel Mierlis, who is an information designer, associate professor of graphic design at Northeastern University, author of Design for Information. She and Paul will be doing this piece on Saturday. We'll talk about that first. Kalima Young is back in the house. She's director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at the Maryland Institute College of Art at MICA. And Stephen Towns is with us, a visual artist whose exhibit, Co-Patriot, is now on display at Gallery CA in Baltimore. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Isabel, let me start with you and you and Paul to kind of describe what is happening this weekend. What is this that you're bringing to Baltimore? Isabel?
Yeah, so I believe it's an event to kind of talk about the power of visualization. So I will start with an event, a talk about the book that I recently wrote and trying to educate others of how the principles of design and bringing visual literacy so that others can actually go on and visualize all this data that surrounds us. And I believe then Paul will follow with a performance, but I bet he'll be better at explaining that.
Yeah, I'll start out with showing some of my work and some data visualizations that I've used to show the I created an animated map of the U.S. prison system that shows the prison growth over 300 years. And I also show a slave density map that I've animated from a slave density map.
A slave density map.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for getting me to clarify that, because I don't think people knew that someone in 1860, a group of people, counted the number of slaves in the South. And it's a pretty amazing map, because in some states, like South Carolina, Mississippi, there were more slaves in the state than there were free people. And I think most people don't realize the number of the disproportionality between slaves and others. And I'll end with a short performance on cello, because a lot of the visualizations that I create, I also write the music and perform the music for those data visualizations.
Oh, wow, that sounds fascinating. I mean, I wish I'd seen these maps before we did the show, so I could get a sense of this. But this might be something you can kind of explore in a greater depth. I mean, the idea, and please, the other, to comment on this and ask questions as well. I mean, just to explore what this means. So, is what the two of you are exploring on Saturday night, is this the idea that you take some intellectual demographic concept and then try to create some medium that lets us see it? I mean, is that what we're talking about?
I think it's more like, if you think of early information, people would just say percentages. Then this new revolutionary thing called a bar graph came out, and pie charts. I mean, they're not that old, but now with technology, we have so many different ways of telling the story, and with like geographical information from GPS tracking, you can take data and just showing it in a different way to explain it in a clearer way.
Go ahead, Isabel.
Oh, okay. It's just so that there's everything is data, right? And so numbers can be data, like if I say one or two or three, right? But then it only becomes information when you actually contextualize them, right? So to go back to eventually what Paul was saying, and I'm not familiar with his visualization of the slaves, but I'm familiar with the other one about the prisons, is that, you know, eventually we have numbers. But then when we say, okay, there is a concentration here or there, so when you start like maps are contexts in which things happen because they have a spatial location, right? And so it's really, I mean, visualizations actually help us understand things by putting them in certain contexts, whether it's context that we understand, such as geography, and so we the space we live that exists around us, or whether it's actually making concrete things that are abstract, such as densities. Densities is an abstract concept, right? So how can we help people understand, policymakers or ourselves or anyone, for any sort of information, whether that is information is digitally available or not, right? I don't know if that helps, but...
No. I want to turn to Kalima and get your response to what you just heard. I mean, what does it say to you as both an artist and activist?
You know, I think I really firmly believe that visualization allows us to understand the ecology of the spaces that we live in, and every container is a part of an ecology. So art lives within a part of an ecosystem of people and places and institutions and power dynamics and decisions that have been made and monuments. So I think visualization is really helpful in especially mapping and helping us to see where we live within this larger ecosystem that we're all sort of moving and pushing our way through. And then also the way that technology has changed so much over the last 20 years, especially with GPS and mobile devices, we are constantly reconfiguring our relationship with space and our relationship with one another and the dynamics of space. Imagine those. So I think it's really unbelievably important for people to use data visualization to have a sense of where they actually exist in the world, because the world is so big and there's a myriad of things that are going on at the same time.
So many things are popping into my head at once here to ask, but let me start. Stephen, what's your response to this?
Well, yeah, this has been amazing. I had no idea about the 1860 count of slaves in the South. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what I address in the work that I'm working on, is that it seems to be this invisibility of people of color in the canon of the American history. And it makes it visible. And that's what I try and do with my work, is make it visible so that people understand that people of color have helped to build this nation and that people of color do matter. And so it's amazing what seeing it can do.
So I wonder, let me just try to get this in my head straight so I can think one at a time and not a million things coming out at one time.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm thinking, first of all, just about how people learn and think, and how this notion of visualization and using these historical facts and other and bar graphs, how that would fit into learning, how that would fit into education, because our education now seems to be so hell-bent on data and testing, and this is the only way that you can understand how people learn. How could this begin to change that? How can this affect the way people learn and young people learn?
Yeah, with the map that I created of the prison system, children can see there are a lot of dots up there. You know, they don't have to explain it. If you say there are 2.3 million people in prison, one out of every 99, you start spouting out numbers to a group of first graders, they're not going to get it. But
right.
If they start seeing a bunch of dots representing buildings or dots representing people or incidents, I mean, that's easier to understand. So I think that's a different way of just communicating. There's actually Baltimore City. The Baltimore Sun has a homicide map. You can go online and you can see where the homicides have taken place. You can filter by race, age, type of death, if it was stabbing, shooting, or whatever, and it's updated regularly. It's pretty amazing. It works really well. Again, it uses GPS information to create this map.
Is this another map you're working on?
I'm actually thinking about doing something with the map. So there were like 224 shootings last year in Baltimore. 189 were African American. I mean, just doing something, and I could make different information color coded to explain the disparity in who's being shot and who's not being shot, or how people are being killed. So yeah, that's something that's a potential project.
Because in some ways, I guess this way, Isabel, in terms of the work you all are doing, it allows people to kind of feel something going through, rather. I mean, and in a deeper way.
Yeah. So. Yes, hopefully. And I think it's everything connects. So, okay, let me just step back a little bit. Sorry, my head went ahead of me. But, you know,
I understand. That happens to me all the time, you know, every day.
Basically, when you're talking about learning, right, the important thing is that, you know, visualizations are cognitive artifacts in that they actually help us, you know, in many ways. One, actually, of offsetting things that are inside our minds to becoming visible, and so that we can share and talk about and learn from, right? So going back to your learning point there. But also so that as a very simple thing, so there is this psychologist called Dan Norman, and he says that it's things that makes us smart. So if we think about adding 1 + 1, we can, everyone think very rapidly and say 2. But if we start multiplying and dividing by complex numbers, we eventually might need just a pencil and paper to write down, or a calculator, right? So the same way that, you know, visualizations can help us discuss and communicate issues. And so I think it's very important as a means for discussion and for actually, you know, advocacy, right? And so the other thing is that actually it helps us asking other questions. So when we see certain densities or certain places where eventually when we map historical data and say, wow, there is a concentration here or there, we might be start asking questions, why is that so, right? Or to use the example that Paul just mentioned about the maps of, you know, homicides, why are certain things happening in certain place and not in other place? What are the social issues involving there, or the lack of infrastructure, for example, right? There is this very beautiful project done 10 years ago by Laura Kruger at Columbia University that actually is called the $1 million block. So she was asking about, you know, where people were incarcerated, and rather than asking where the crimes were happening, so that, you know, eventually all the money that is being spent in incarceration is actually being spent in terms of, you know, social infrastructure of where those people lived that actually, you know. So there, huh. I think, you know, there are different ways that we can use these visual artifacts for learning and for acting.
So there's so much again I want to ask here, but let me pare it down here. Stephen, what were you thinking and writing as she was talking?
I was thinking about how using these data visualizations shows a systematic approach to how things are happening, and it can really bring about the question, like she was saying, why are these things happening? Like, what's happening in these areas, and what are the social structures that are contaminating a community to not encourage, but why is there violence there? Why are people hurting each other? Why are people murdering each other?
Yeah, I think the word, I think what's not coming up is correlation. You can find correlation between so many different things. And there's a map that I'm working with now that shows correlation between education, former land where slavery happened, poverty, child maltreatment deaths, diabetes, and religious groups as well. So you can see a direct correlation. I mean, if you look at this map in the red zones to where a lot of the same problems still exist that happened, you know, even 200 or 300 years ago, and the correlation between poverty and the crime rate. I mean, but there's also this disparity in opportunity. There's so many variables in any kind of things. You can't make a blanket statement. It's like in your last talk, I mean, it was really great to hear these things, but there's so many things about racism that are, it makes it so stealth and so powerful. So approaching it from any one way, you wouldn't get, you miss a bigger picture.
And what you just said, and what I thought about as soon as what you just said, and looking very quickly at those maps you just passed over to me, I'd love to really sit with those and think through what you're doing. But people have been talking more and more in this century, and especially since Barack Obama became president and all the things have been going on around us, like the killings and Ferguson and the rest, about the notion of institutional racism or systemic racism. Mm-hmm. And every time I hear those words, I mean, people hear those words, most people go, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, how do you define that? How do you put that in a place so people understand it. And I you know, so if someone's African American, the viscerally will understand it because it's part of existence. But there's a larger population that said, what does that mean? And I'm thinking about how the works you all are doing and working in, how that opens that conversation up in a different way, to kind of get under it in a way that people can feel it and see it rather than try to intellectualize it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. One of the most important things for me last year, informing my exhibit, was seeing 12 Years a Slave.
Uh-huh.
And that art form made slavery real to me. I had remembered learning about it in high school, in middle school, in college, and slavery was sort of just glossed over. And it wasn't until I saw that movie that I got it, that there is a whole systemic approach to that, that there's a whole psychology between the person that's enslaved, the slave master, and the whole family, and our whole community. And then after I saw that movie, I read the book. I read the other book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, by Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Incidents of a Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Ann Jacobs. And so it was really three interesting approaches, one from a white woman who was an abolitionist, one from a free man who was enslaved, and then another from a woman who was enslaved who was free. And all of those art forms really informed for me what slavery was and the psychology of slavery and how it affects how things are today. And I thought that this would make me more angry learning about this stuff, but actually I became less angry because I understood. And the important thing about art is just affirming what your beliefs are, not what your beliefs are, but what you experience. Like, systemic racism does exist, and it happened because slavery is the very foundation of what American history is. It is how our economy was built. So mm-hmm. to say that it just automatically disappeared is not very true.
Right. And that's where I feel maps are really important, because they visibilize the invisible. Say, for instance,
visibilize the invisible.
Right.
I like that.
So say, for instance, you're trying to map where the channels were, where slave ports, you know, where slaves were brought in or where auction blocks are. Imagine a map that actually shows you where those places are across the U.S. and what's on top of those spaces right now, because we constantly build on top of this invisible trauma that's living at the undercurrent of our entire mm-hmm. country. We're living off of it, and those energy still lives in those spaces. So imagine if you had a map or maps of the places, the slave ports where people were brought in, and then you see what's built on top of it. Let's take Lexington Market, for example, a place where it was an auction block where black people were bought and sold. Why does the energy in Lexington Market feel the way that it does? Because people were bought and sold in that space. So what's been built on top of these places of trauma? And things like data visualization and mapping can really give us an idea of those invisible undercurrents of traumatic ideas, spaces, and systemic spaces, and then we can see what's built on top of it and maybe start seeing sort of this correlation between place, space, and memory that all live in everything that we're in.
Yeah, may I interject?
Please, Isabel, do, and then we'll go to Paul. Yeah,
yeah,
please do.
And, yeah. And I love both points there, and I just want to say again that it's like I just thought about two projects very rapidly. So one is about actually mapping the media, what the media talks about, and where what they don't talk about or how they talk about, right? So eventually there's this interesting project done by the civic media group at MIT here that actually was looking at Boston Globe, right? And what they found was that eventually they were talking about certain neighborhoods always in a negative way, right? So, you know, those things can help us also in terms of discussion. And again, goes to the point of making maps. And the other interesting project was actually a map project in California about cabs and where the cabs were not going, right? So eventually, sometimes it's also looking at other things that are not directly related to the social injustice, but actually inform us in very powerful ways.
Okay, Paul. I'm sorry. I'll wait. Go ahead, Paul.
No, that's great. I'm actually working on a map from the West to the Atlantic Passage. I just visited Liverpool and London last month, and I visited the International Slave Museum. Mm-hmm. And Liverpool, which is, most people don't know, Liverpool is the international slave port. Mm-hmm. And in the exhibit that I'd love to see here in America is happening there. And I learned so much about the history, and I was able to get maps and other information there. And they spell it out. They have sections on the colonizations of who colonized what part of Africa. They have a section on reparations. They have a section on the Black Power movement. Mm-hmm. The most comprehensive American exhibit on slavery, again, is in Liverpool.
It's in Liverpool.
And
that says something.
And they name names as well. I mean, we know the song Penny Lane. Mm-hmm. Penny was a slave trader. He owned two shipping companies. Mm-hmm. And they didn't change the title. And and we also have a Penny Lane here in Baltimore. So I'm working on making a parallel between the two cities, because both cities, Seattle and Baltimore and
Liverpool
really benefited a lot from trade. They benefited a lot, and they both also have had a large fall, an economic fall. But I'm working on a map to show the trade routes as well, mm-hmm. and then connect the ports. And I wanted to mention the economic impact, as you mentioned earlier, is invisible. Mm-hmm. But if you look at 1860, the U.S. provided 75% of the cotton to Europe.
Right.
75% of cotton, and that was only 60% of our exports. And in 1860 money, that equaled $200 million. So,
wow.
That's a lot. That's a big part of our history that's erased or being glossed over. And yeah. One more thing, there, like you mentioned, Lexington Market. There's an area in Tribeca where there's a slave burial ground,
mm-hmm.
and the federal government, they were building a new building there, mm-hmm. and they discovered the ground. I think it was in the early 90s.
Yeah, 94.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Think about it. They discovered it in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this estimated between 15,000 and 30,000 slaves buried in that area in Tribeca. Right.
15 to 30,000,
yeah. And there's a monument there as well. And,
so was it built over?
They had a competition to have a little bit. There's a little small park there, and there's a little monument there. But they built around it. So all over Tribeca, they've already built over the slave grounds. And This again, 94 was not the first time that they heard about this. They found on the new spot, they were digging bones. They found bones. They put them to the side. They kept finding. They finally said, "Okay, we have to stop." And then they had to do something. And there was a ceremony with the community, but they gave them like a quarter of an acre. I think that's the size of the park. But
We have to take a break.
Okay.
I mean, for a lot of reasons, we have to take an official break. We're going to go to break here with Ernie Field, the swing jazz musician, band leader at the Tulsa-based Royal Entertainers, and was born on this day. So here we go.
They were digging a new foundation in Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. May their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon. We've moved on to the electric.
Annie DeFranco, Fuel, starts with a verse about the slave graveyard in Tribeca that we were talking about. So
it's a great album, by the way. Tiny Little Plastic Castles, yeah, great album.
And, of course, thanks to Stephanie Mavronis for popping that up through our head and putting it on the airways for us, or whoever did it over across the glass. So that's really good. It was Mark Gunnery, excuse me, who gave it to Stephanie, who gave it to us. Okay, I'll give that justice where justice is due. So we continue this conversation about the power of visualization, the power of design, the power of mapping, the power of the artistic spirit to interpret the world and move things ahead for us, given what we're really wrestling with in America. And I think this is there's no mistake in our culture and world why the 13% of American people define this country and have been defined by it and define it in itself. And we are here with Isabel Mieres, who is an information designer, associate professor of graphic design at Northeastern University, author of Design for Information, who, along with Paul Rucker, artist in residence at the Maryland Institute College of Art at MICA, are having this opening their work this Saturday at 6:30 at the Gateway B Box at MICA. More information at hbradbury@mica.edu or 410-225-2282, and we'll have all that on our website as well. Joining us in the discussion is Kalima Young, director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at MICA, and Stephen Towns, a visual artist whose exhibit Co/Patriot is now on exhibit at Gallery CA in Baltimore. And please join us here at 410-319-8888. A lot of artists listen to the show. We'd love to hear your thinking on this. Activists listen to the show, like to hear your thinking on this. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also log on to our Facebook page, tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Okay, so there's a power here, I think, that gets unexplored. And one of the things I was thinking about during the as we were going to break was this kind of artistic interpretation of who we are and what we could be and where we've come from and where we're going and how important it is. How do the four of you think you cannot just get lost inside of small artistic worlds? So I'm saying, I mean, so we have this thing at MICA, but this is a kind of, you have your stuff at the art gallery and all the work people do, but this is explosive in terms of how we look at ourselves and interpret where we're going and who we are. So how do you think that gets out further beyond just the small circles that often come to see it? And that's not diminishing it either. Just trying to see, how does it go beyond it, do you think?
That's been the big challenge of launching this exhibit and advertising it and to talking to people about it. I want everybody to be able to see it, but I also want people to see it that normally wouldn't come and see work with people of color in it. One of the most rewarding aspects of showing this work and showing it in the space that I'm showing it in is that young people, young women of color and black men and black people of all ages walk by the window, they see images of themselves, and they stare in the window. And if I'm there, I'll tell them to come in. And the first thing I hear is, I know that person. They feel like they know that person. In my paintings. And so, again, it's that thing of making the invisible person who doesn't see themselves in media, who doesn't see them in self in art, see themselves. And that's been the most rewarding aspect.
Where is Gallery CA?
Gallery CA is off of East Oliver Street. It's on the corner of East Oliver and Greenmount Avenue.
The address is
440 East Oliver Street.
I'll take a run down there. That's why I've never been there. So now I'm going to see this. I mean, so let's expand this a bit more. Your thoughts, Paul?
Yeah, I think sometimes there's this gee whiz factor with new technology or even some forms of art. People, I mean, like, for example, Proliferation is my animated video on YouTube. You know, it's got about 10,000 plays. But a cat playing piano is going to have a lot more plays. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, this ice bucket challenge, you know, or people getting hit in the groin or something. Those things are the things that get more plays. You also don't want to dumb down your art for anyone. You want there to be some kind of a real connection. And like you said, that's the challenge. It really is an ongoing challenge. But I think it starts really early, and a lot of it has to do with arts education, keeping it in the schools and actually having quality art education. And, you know, I've worked with many kids who've only been at the museum once, and that was with that one class trip, and they never go back again, and many have never been at all. And same with the symphony, and same with any kind of other art form, you know, if you're not being exposed. And there's a great power in seeing someone that looks like you. Mm-hmm. I played in orchestras for years, and I played with the South Carolina Philharmonic and Augusta Symphony and opera companies. And I was the only...
You were a cellist.
I was a cello. Actually, I was a bassist then. Okay. And I didn't start playing cello until a few years later. But as a bass player in the orchestra, you know, many times I'd be the only one in the orchestra and sometimes the only one in the whole room during the concert. But I didn't realize at that time. Now, as I'm older, I'm realizing, boy, if I had seen more role models, or someone, if the conductor had been a person of color, or if the you know, we need to have role models outside of sports, outside in other areas. And I remember one of the most exciting things about coming to Baltimore for me was I flew into Baltimore and I passed by airline pilots that were black. And there were more people that were working in other jobs that were not just these service positions in Baltimore. And that's something that I missed in Seattle because, I mean, Seattle's population is a low percentage of black folk. But it's very empowering to see black figures in art. If you go to some of the art museums or most art museums in the world, you'll not see black figures. And if you see a black figure in the art museum, it's most likely Kehinde Wiley, you know, one of the artists now that's getting a lot of attention for painting black figures. And what are the outfits? Is it like Renaissance type outfits? It varies.
For him, I think he paints a lot of Renaissance portraits, and they're all referenced to older paintings of white people, and he puts people of color in those paintings.
I wanted to get to the phone too, but I want to let so Sean and Karita, we're going to come to your call in just like 5 minutes or less, but I wanted to allow Isabel and Kalima to jump in there too. Isabel?
Yeah, and so I think I want to go back to what I said about visualizations being an artifact for conversation and storytelling. So basically, I agree with Paul and what one of your first questions, Mark, in terms of, you know, what about education, right? So I think there is a room for actually bringing to high school or even, you know, earlier in K-12 education to discuss, to talk, and to help people map their stories or their, you know, create genealogical trees. Or, you know, all these are visualizations that can help us understand and share and talk and actually discover what is missing. Or so I really believe in the power of actually having these as conversation, as starting points to learn more stuff. So
Yeah, I definitely co-sign. I definitely think giving people the power to be able to map out their things that are important to their identity, to trace their histories, to trace their way of existing in the world, and showing them ways to do that through visualization or art's extremely important. I also think the conversation of how do we bring art out into the community, we actually have to take it out into the community. You know, we can't keep people. It's great to go into a museum. It's great to go into the symphony, but you actually have to bring it to the neighborhoods where people are and where people are doing their work. And think we also have to switch our ideas of what we consider art. Art is ritual practice, and everyone participates in it in some way, shape, or form. So if we keep that in mind, there are artists that are living in neighborhoods who have been doing art. And we might not consider it high art, it is art that is there. And I think that those are sort of some approaches that we need to think about in terms of breaking this idea of art being in one space and not being another. If you think about it as ritual practice that we do together.
I was thinking about, you know, Tyrone West family, who were on the show a great deal, the young man who was killed at the hands of the Baltimore police. Yeah. He was an artist. Yeah, it was an incredible artist who actually won. I just put this as an aside because, you know, about art being everywhere. Mm-hmm. While he was in prison, people know he was in prison, he won the WEAA artist contest about 10 years ago here. I mean, and he was an amazing artist when you see his work. He was just, you know, very talented. But just made me think of that as you were saying that. 410-319-8888. Sean, you're on the air.
Yes,
welcome.
Hi to your panel and
welcome.
To Mark. I am actually very excited about what you, what your panel was speaking about today, because I've had a vision for this type of artwork to exist within communities for a very long time, and I have not acted upon it, but I definitely will be showing up on Saturday. And also, again, I will be visiting Gallery CA. Very briefly, my idea will contribute to uplifting of black males and a black family unit one community at a time by taking photographs or using a photograph where men are involved with their children, whether it be playing baseball or reading to them on their live photographs, and teaching young adults to actually place those photographs on murals, on vacant homes, and actually making sales as well by creating calendars and laptop covers and so forth, so that they can become entrepreneurs. So I really would like to speak with Stephen, Paul, Isabel, or Kalina in the future about putting this plan to work.
That's well, we'll see you at the gallery. We'll see you Saturday night. That's interesting. Paul, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think it goes back to image. I think there's just demonization. And I go back to Trayvon Martin because he's probably one of the best examples of a person who was demonized. He was put on trial. You know, Zimmerman was not put on trial during that time. And it's really tricky. This is the bias that takes place, like in classrooms, and people who think they're aware are not aware that they call on the white male more than they. And I'm talking about white females do this as well. You know, there's this institutionalized sexism, racism. There's a lot of isms out there, and I think was it Michael Moore, and I can't remember what movie it was, but it might have been Bowling for Columbine. But he had this whole black male sequence. When there was a crime committed, they would say the race and that. Ethnicity if it was a person of color, but if it was not a person of color, they wouldn't say white. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this has been this long history of framing of and demonization of images of certain folks of color, and that's something that needs to be worked on. But I think it also starts in education again. I'm not sure exactly how we do that. There needs to be some kind of training that's incorporated with all teachers before they graduate, before they're certified as teachers, that talks more about biases, you know, and how we interact with each other. And it goes pretty deep and long. But, yeah, I think helping the community, empowering the community, I think it's a great idea, but I think there needs to be many angles, including your great idea of the. I like the mural idea because I was just trying to think how many positive mural images of just the average guy, average black male playing with his children. I think that would be a powerful mural mm-hmm. in Seattle.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because I mean, I think that because part of this is that the non-African population of America has to see this and be in it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, mm-hmm. that's the only way that, I mean, that is that a change in consciousness has to take place. And this is part of a change in consciousness, I think, that has to envelop the whole of society.
Yeah. I also want to say real quick that the whole people think of shoplifters. I mean, they talk about how Michael's shoplifting before the incident. But the average shoplifter in America is a 16-year-old white female.
Right.
But if you were to ask otherwise, it's, you know, people would think differently. But I just want to bring that up before.
Right. And then we'll go to the phone, too, but go ahead and I'll go right to the phones.
Yeah, I think it's very important that there's a change in consciousness because the big thing for me is just knowing that my experience was real. And if people create this work, we must value their voice. Unless we value their voice, then they feel like their work is worthless. So the big thing is valuing the voice of the person that's making that work.
It's validating people's reality. We do the same thing in like rape crisis intervention. Validate the experiences that you have.
Let me open the phones here again. 410-319-8888. Karita, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
I was calling to kind of bring up the point about making visible the black female experience within the context of the black American experience. I feel like we're talking a lot about how we are able to visualize the way that blackness is portrayed and exists in this country. And I'm wondering how, particularly how the artists are sort of bringing in the black female experience into that. Because I feel like that is a part of that description that has been largely made invisible.
Huh, that's a really, I think that's so real.
In the beginning, I had been largely interested in painting just black male figures as a black male. Seeing 12 Years a Slave and actually reading the book Incidents of a Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Ann Jacobs, it blew my mind. It was that book that made me realize that black women, this may be a weird statement, but black women are the foundation of America. They have cared for America. They have mm-hmm. cared. They have nursed children, little white babies, little black babies, and they are the foundation of America. So I am working on creating more work with black women, and especially in the Co-Patriot exhibit, there are a number of women. Actually, Kalima is one of my models for one of my paintings, and there's a whole wall of black women with Kalima and Michelle Obama and how black women have been portrayed in the media and how black women are important.
So let me turn to our women before we go back to the phones here. Isabel and then Kalima.
Well, I'm originally from Brazil, right? So and that's where my accent comes from. And I, you know, I feel the same in terms of how you know, it's a very different environment in Brazil in terms of different prejudices that exist down there, and but eventually not there is a very different prejudice here in America that I felt when I came here because it's so strong. But on the other hand, people don't talk, so it's a kind of a hidden, and I think that's what actually makes it even stronger. So I very much appreciate the conversation and also the visualizations that I can help advance the conversation so that it becomes more visible and there is less bias, because I completely agree in terms of the bias. And being a woman and Latina, you know, I suffer here experiences that I don't suffer in Europe or in other parts of the world, in Asia, right? And so, but I can only, you know, sort of imagine the source of prejudice that Black women actually suffer here because of what I see happening. So,
You know, just thinking about that, and thank you very much to the caller for your thoughts and Stephen for what you've added and Isabel. You know, when I think about that, I think about Melissa Harris Perry's book, Sister Citizen. And you did really great on the show, by the way.
Thank you.
and I think about the analogy that she uses of Black women are always trying to stand upright in a crooked room.
Mm-hmm.
And how controlling images, you know, Patricia Hill Collins, you know, about that idea of the controlling images, and how we're always fighting against these controlling images of who we are and our place in this country and what the lines that we serve, and how as Black women try to stand up straight in this crooked room to make it somehow make sense when it's just completely skewed, how important visualization is to that, how important combating controlling images are, how important it is for artists to bring women into their practice and for women to be elevated in the practice that they do when they are making visualization, because it shows that unique perspective that everyone builds off. We can create a theory like intersectionality and 5,000 other people will take it and use it in ways that do not benefit Black women. Our worth is always being absconded and used for other people's purposes. So I think visualization and the power of art has a really great way to assert our vision of sort of this crooked existence that we're standing around in.
Pardon me, I'm sorry. You want to say, we have a number of callers I want to get to as well.
Okay. Just add one sentence. Black women's achievements are not noticed. I mean, Black women are 6 times more likely to attend college than Black men. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's something that you don't hear about in the news. And that's all I want to say about that.
And we we get paid so much less than anyone. You know, I'm getting my PhD right now, and I looked at a study that's just like the average like Black female PhD makes $80,000 a year. The average male PhD makes over $120,000. So think about that.
But then it changes, though. I have to say, it's white male and it's white women, but then Black men. So it's not really, doesn't really alternate. So when you say males, you really have to specify. White males.
Yeah.
410-319-8888. Eugene in Nottingham, you're on the air.
Hi. How you doing, people?
Very well, Eugene.
It's an interesting point. I was going to make one, but she brought up something interesting. She said Black female PhDs get paid less than males. But I, from my understanding, I think Black female PhDs get paid more than Black males, I believe.
I don't know all the stats, but I'm not sure of the stats. We can look all those up.
What I wanted to say was that I definitely applaud any kind of program that uplifts, you know, awareness and understanding. I also think it's important, and I'm from Brooklyn, I'm 45 years old and grew up in the inner city. I think it's important that individually we take responsibility for our own behavior, meaning we need to do the right things when we're out there and not try to put ourselves in positions where we can't be taken advantage of, because there's enough out there targeted against Black people and Hispanics and any kind of minority type of demographic. Well, you don't have to do anything to add to it in terms of behavior, in terms of how you carry yourself, how you speak to people, how you speak to authorities. I think a lot of us need to do a better job ourselves of being as respectful to each other as we can and not put ourselves in positions where we can be taken advantage of more.
Appreciate your respectability politics.
Thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, there's this in schools, as kids as young as 5 or 6, there's a disparity in prosecution and selective enforcement of laws. And if you have suspension rates among black kids that are 6 to 10 times higher for doing the same things white kids are doing, you can't put it all on people and certain groups and their actions. We have to take into account to who the laws are being enforced by and who's enforcing the laws and the sentencing process. I mean, if we have a 12% black population and 40% of the prison population is black and there's a big disparity there, are we saying that black people can commit more crimes? No, that's not the truth. That's not a fact. But again, there's disparity in prosecution and selective enforcement of laws. So we have to, that needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, and again, it is that thing about valuing people's voice and making visible the invisible. After reading the material that I read and doing research for this particular exhibition, I realized that I wasn't crazy. Like, I was experiencing things that other people weren't experiencing. So I think the first thing that needs to happen is just to acknowledge people and tell them, you're not crazy. Things are very unfair for you. And I think sometimes, well, for myself, when I don't understand that, that's when rage happens. That's when anger happens. Now that I know that I'm not crazy and things are different, I can figure out how can I navigate myself through these muddy waters? How can I navigate myself through this uneven foundation? And I think that's the big conversation that's missing. It's always about pull up your pants or speak the king's English. It's more than that. We have to acknowledge things are not fair. Your experience is your experience. So how can you navigate through this experience?
Yeah, if I may say something, I think that actually visualizations can help in terms of as design strategies, right? So that it actually can point to problems that we are seeing or we have. We do it through research that using the data, right? So it's easy to show certain things in mappings, as we already talked. But then it can be used as a strategy for what's going to be next, how we're going to act upon, you know, the problems that we are actually being able to see that they are real, right? And I think that can help a lot.
Let me just add a little quick thing here before we go to the phones. My producers just pulled this up. Stephanie pulled this up, that black men with professional degrees make more than black women with professional degrees. Black men with professional degrees make slightly more than white women with professional degrees. That so they just look up the stat for us. That was a bit confusing earlier. So 410-319-8888. Dana in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Dana.
I was reading this article and the responses of the article that was written somewhere in New York. It's about the Kara Walker exhibit and how white people would go, this exhibit is, you know, about the whole, you know, slavery.
Oh,
and,
right, Kara Walker, right. Uh-huh. Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead, yeah.
Uh-huh. So now, when people were there, the first time apparently the writer went there, there were white people taking pictures, you know, of themselves behind the ladies derriere, and they would be laughing, making jokes. Parents would then take pictures of their kids. With their little, you know, just the children's slaves, because they're supposed to be caricatures. Obviously, the woman, the artist who did this, was saying, you know, many things. It was volumes and volumes and volumes of interpretation that went into that work, and her work is amazing. However, the responses to this one person that went to see the exhibit, and then ended up yelling at some white people, telling them, look, we can't make fun of people where our pain is still there. It's like, you know, those the burial places, so you can't continue to build over people's history and people's pains, never acknowledging it, and then have the goal to go and take photos and post it on Facebook with you with this black woman behind,
mm-hmm.
and laugh in the presence of other people of color, black and Native Americans or whatever. So the responses, however, were ridiculous. They were like, well, you know, the Jews always make fun of the Holocaust because that's Jewish humor. So the Jewish humor, the best Jewish humor is, you know, the noir or whatever. So, and it's like, What are you talking about?
So look, I'm only interrupting you, Dana, because we only have like 3 minutes left before we have to leave the air for the day, and everybody has one thing to say. I know Paul looks like he's ready to.
Yeah, I attended the show, the Kara Walker Show in New York. There were lines around the block, and I also read the article you're referring to. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a much bigger picture. It was a spectacle. It was a spectacle. I mean, there's not a lot of information about the history. The history is supposed to highlight the use of child labor in the early part of our century. But the same thing happens at Alcatraz. I've done some work at Alcatraz, and people will pose behind prison bars and have their picture taken. So there's a desensitization of the real cause that happens many times when there's something like this, and that's where the education component is really important.
Yeah, and spectacle. Black people's pain in this country has always been spectacle.
That's a very powerful short statement. Mm-hmm. It's true.
And I think that project lends itself to it, and these are the examples and responses that are going to occur.
Well, I want to thank the four of you, and I want to encourage everybody to go, and I'm really, really going to try to get there Saturday night as well, at 6:30 at the Gateway B Box at Micah to see Isabel Mieros and Paul Rucker and their work there that night. It should be a fascinating evening. And Stephen Towns come over to East Oliver and Greenmount to see his work there at Gallery CA.
And yeah, I'll be there Friday night, so if you come Friday from 7 to 10 p.m. at Gallery CA, I'll be there.
All right, cool. I wish I might not have to go to the theater. Opening night for every man, but I will get over there. I really want to see it and see it with you there. And Kalima Young, always great to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for all that you bring to everything.
Always.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And thank you all. See you all this weekend.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Folks, on the way out of here, I want to remind you, I want to remind you something really important, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. And their banner is at steinershow.org. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Sianna Greaves. You can hear the show again, podcast, any of our past shows, find out information about our guests and what we've referred to today on the show. Please go to our website at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer, we are going out with Ernie Fields and his orchestra, Chattanooga Choo Choo. It's his birthday. I'm Mark Steiner. Stay creative. Take care.